Welcome everybody to Integrate Yourself. I'm your host, Allison Pillow, and you can find me at pureenergypdx.com and finallythrivingbook.com. Today we have a very special guest on the show, Angie Check. Angie is Paul Check's wife, one of his wives, and she is coming on the show today to talk about labyrinths. This was a show I've been wanting to do for some time, especially since I talk about walking the path of the labyrinth in my book, Finally Thriving, and how it's important to tune into and connect with the energy of the labyrinth in your work, in your life. Whatever you're learning, it's a circular spiral way that we can look at life energetically to let go of what is not needed as we go through the path and become open to new things, learning in the middle. And then as you spiral back out, you can pick up on integrating everything that you've learned and share it with the world as well integrate it in your own life. That's the integration period. And so that's what I talked about in my book and how I use that with my clients and their path to wellness. Today, Angie is going to share more detail about what she knows about the labyrinth. She is a certified shaman, and she's also certified in biogeometry. We touch upon that as well today and how she uses it in her work to help people, and her own practice of building labyrinths in her backyard. And she shares a lot of great information about how you can use it in your own life, how easy it can be. It doesn't even have to be something you're building in your backyard, as she mentions in the show today. You can even do a small labyrinth. You can even build a small labyrinth in your office and use that daily to get you back into balance and harmony with yourself. And we also talk about mythology and how it relates to our lives and how we see the world, how that can heal us, so much more. So many great topics today in the show. I want to let everybody know that I am coming out with a program. Finally Thriving program is going to be a companion program to the book Finally Thriving. If you've gotten the book and you really love it and you want to dig deeper, you want to have a lot of support around creating an empowered wellness state, learn how to integrate everything that I talked about in the book, and like I said, dive deeper into your relationship with yourself, this is the program to sign up for. It's going to be so much fun. It's a 12-week program, and we're going to have a live group coaching call with me every week. I have some special guest speakers coming in as well, and we're going to, you know, start with default, that our brain default, like aligning our mind and working with that. We're going to get into how to create some intention in our life with some learning how to build energy statements is what I call it, when I've learned from my teacher, Hannah Beer. And we're going to also learn how to use our imagination and tap into our inner creativity, which comes from our inner child. And I'm going to explore that more with this group as we get into it. We're then going to connect to our body through our breathing and our movement and our voice, and which is going to be super fun. I love teaching things about voice and how that relates to your breath and how it's really a great expression of health in your life. And we're going to also go through that together. And then finally, we're going to talk about how to listen to your spirit, how to really tap into your intuition. Not only that, but just to do it in a way that works for you, that's individual to you. And we're going to learn how together, how you do that on, like I said, on an individual basis. Like, we're all different in that way, in how we use our intuition, what kind of information we pick up on. So we're going to explore all of that and then bring it all together at the very end and create a practice that is going to be sustainable, a practice of wellness that you love doing every day. And that's going to really help you prioritize yourself, which is really the main obstacle and challenge people fall into when they create, when they start a wellness practice. It's not just about what to eat and how to move. It goes much deeper than that, because as we all know, we have beliefs, we have values that we do definitely want to connect with before we start a big change in our life, because change for some people is different than others. Some people are very scared of change. So we're going to go into this and together, and it's going to be so much fun. So I hope you will join me on this journey. It starts June 7th, and you can sign up on the link that I provide in the show notes here. You can just go over to the page, read about it, sign up for a discovery call with me, and then if it sounds good to you, we'll get you signed up. As well, you can find my book, Finally Thriving, Your Guide to Empowered Wellness, at Amazon. You can also go to finallythrivingbook.com and pick up your copy today. So as you probably have noticed, I don't use affiliates or sponsors on the show. I have not for some time now. And that's because I felt like the best thing I can offer you all is my own services, my own offerings. I feel like that at this point, it's the best that I can do to offer you a lot of value. And the show is all about aspects of health. I'm doing my best to bring in the best people to give you some ideas on creatively creating a wellness practice that you love, and looking at health from all aspects, because there's so many different ways to get healthy. So if you feel inspired to give back to the show, the best way to do it is to support me and my show by and really, you're supporting yourself if you take part in that. Even just buying the book, I feel like, is going to be really great for you to start prioritizing yourself, creating a new relationship with yourself. And as we know, creating a relationship with yourself really spills out to all your relationships, because our perspective is coming from ourselves, and that's how we relate to the world. So having a healthy relationship with yourself creates so many more healthy relationships in your life. And it also creates it creates more energy and less depletion in your life, because now you're building relationships that are really meaningful for you, because your relationship with yourself is meaningful and you're prioritizing that. You know yourself enough to know what kind of people to hang out with, to know what to attract in your life, to live with intention and purpose and gratitude. So this is so important, and the big reason why I wrote the book, because I wanted to share that with everyone, what I've experienced, as well as what I've helped my clients experience within themselves. You know, everybody has a way of doing it. Everybody's individual, and I want to help each and every one of you on that path, on that journey to empowered wellness. So if you'd like to support yourself and take part in these offerings, it would be amazing. And I really appreciate you all for listening. And if you do have a copy of the book and you want to go even further with that support, it'd be great if you'd leave a review on Amazon, and that will give people an idea of your experience of the book, which is always fantastic for both me to read and other people. So thank you so much for being a listener here. And I appreciate y'all very much. Much love to you. So without further ado, it is my honor and my pleasure to introduce you to Angie Check, everybody. Enjoy. Today, I'm here with a really special guest, Angie Check. She is a holistic lifestyle coach, and she teaches others how to be a coach. She's with the Czech Institute, which offers three levels of HLC coaching, which can be taken online or in person. She also holds a master in nutrition and a bachelor's in biology. And she has various degrees in energy medicine and biogeometry. Angie is a graduate of Michael Harner's three-year program in shamanism, and she first learned about Labrys, which is what we're going to talk about today, when she attended mystery school in 2011. So, oh my God, we have so many amazing things to talk about. We're going to talk about the history of Labrys today. We're going to talk about mythology and how she teaches people how to build their own Labrys and use it that way for many things. I'm not going to list them, but she can kind of explain while we're here, but personal growth. And also I'll just share right off the bat that I use the idea of the labyrinth for teaching. So, you know, we go in, we release what we don't need anymore. We get to the middle, we take it all in, you know, and then we integrate it. And then as you circle back out, you're integrating it more into your life through sharing, through teaching, or just living that information that you take in. It could be many layers of walking that labyrinth with one particular idea, right? Or one particular lesson. So that's how I use it in my work with my clients too. But I want to really get into much more about how you teach people how to use the labyrinths, the history of labyrinths. But first, please share more about yourself, how you got into the history of labyrinths, how I want to hear more about this mystery school. Sure. And just please share.
So that's where I first learned about labyrinths, was in mystery school. And I really didn't know about them. I've seen them, you know, I didn't really understand them. Maybe I just was like, oh, that's a cool design. I had probably walked a few by before I went to mystery school, but it was just, I didn't know what to feel or what to think or anything, but it was just kind of like, oh, that's nice. And so in mystery school, I had the opportunity to actually create a labyrinth. And so you can actually make them with flour, and we sprinkled flour. So we had a bunch of students. There was 11 circuit labyrinth that we made. So we had 11 students standing with bags of flour with funnels, and we just walked around letting flour go until we created these circuits. And then the instructor went ahead and put in the turns and twists, you know, that were in there, all with flour. Well, we did this on the full moon, and flour glows in the dark, which is really, really cool.
Oh,
and
wow.
So we were able to walk the labyrinth on a full moon. And that's when I really had my first deep experience with a labyrinth. And I went, wow, there's more to this than just a cool design on the ground. And so, you know, I learned a little bit about them. And in school, we learned about using them as a diagnostic tool. And so the specific one I use is very similar to the one in the Schwarz Cathedral. So I actually have a picture of that one. This is similar to the Schwarz one. You'll see it. This one's called a simple Schwarz. So
yes,
those of you online can see it. The difference is the original Schwarz Cathedral one has a flower, petals, a six petal flower in the center. And then it has these little lunations on the outside that look like little U's, almost like you could put a candle in each lunation. And I think there's 144 of them around the outside. And that makes it a true Schwarz labyrinth. So mine is a simple Schwarz. And so that it's very similar to the one I just posted right there. And I built one later, I'm going to share with you, in my backyard. But that's the one I learned about in school. And it showed you that you can use it to figure out what's going on inside your body. So you can, based on where you trip or fall or get dizzy, those are clues to what is out of balance. And so so that's really quite exciting, because you can, even if you don't feel it, it's still working on you. So that's the best thing. So a person can walk a labyrinth and go, huh? Like my first experience. Okay. You know, is this like, I'm not sure. I felt calm after I left. I remember the first time I ever walked a friend's labyrinth, but I didn't know what else to experience. And so it works on you no matter what, which is the blessing. It's like, you don't have to know anything about a labyrinth to enjoy a labyrinth. And so when I was in school, they taught you about the elements that are associated to the four directions that are also incorporated in this. And as you go into the center, it's like working internally on you. What is out of balance with the four elements internally? And then as you're coming out, what's out of balance externally? So in your environment, that's out of balance. And so with the four elements, you can see, is it water, earth, air, fire? You know, what is it that is out of balance in me that needs to be addressed? And so it's a great way to reflect. And so that's where I learned about it first. And so fast forward 10 years later, you know, I went ahead and when I moved to this property we're at now, we're in San Diego, where we bought a 14-acre property. I started connecting to the land. And as you saw my background, I do a lot of shamanic work. So I built an altar and I connected to the spirits of the land. And what should I build on this property? And the first thing that came to me was, you need to build a labyrinth.
Oh, wow.
And all of a sudden I got this exciting surge in me. I'm like, yes. And it was like the spirit of the labyrinth, like, took over me. And it was just like, I got possessed by the archetype of the labyrinth. And Paul was just laughing at me because he's just like, what is going on with you? It's like, he's like, I've never seen you so excited. And it was like, it's just this surge of energy. I'm like, I got to build this. And he's like, well, go for it. We've got plenty of land. Where do you want to build it? I'm like, I don't know. I just have to build this property. So I started hiking around, feeling the area, trying to figure out where the best location was, what direction it would face, all these things. And when I was going through this process, I would literally wake up in the middle of the night and I'd see a red glowing labyrinth on the ceiling. Wow. And I'd wake up and I'd be like, whoa. And it wasn't scary at all. It was just this energy that was in my field. And I was like, yes. And it was always a little bit off to the right of me. So it wasn't directly above me. Maybe that would have been a little scary, but it was always like here, you know? And I was like,
yeah,
it's speaking to me and communicating to me and telling me about this. And so I decided to build the Schartz Labyrinth. And that's the one I shared with you, because that's the one I learned about in school.
Right.
And when I was building it, what came to me as a vision is, we're on the rainbow property. It's called the Rainbow Estate. And I thought, I need to build it as a rainbow. And the beauty about it is, because there was 11 circuits, it's actually can be broken down into the 7 chakras.
Oh,
and
wow.
So the chakra system is alive and well in this circuit. And so they taught us in mystery school, which circuit was the first chakra, which one was the second, which was third. And so I just, you know, I decided I would make it in rainbow stones. So my labyrinth actually is a rainbow of colors. And so it starts with red, you know, it goes and it's really beautiful. So when you look at it, it's just all the colors, different stones. And that makes it actually really easy when you walk it to know where you have an imbalance, because you trip over the red stone. Oh, root. You trip over the green stone. Oh, I mean, my heart, you know, so you don't have to know too much about the labyrinth. You just have to remember the color. And then I can explain which chakra it is later.
I love that.
So it's important also to name your labyrinth if you do decide to build one. And it's great to have a simple name, not a promise. Like some people started building labyrinths and they're like the enlightenment labyrinth, you know? And it's like,
right.
Well, that's, you know, saying that anybody who walks is going to become enlightened. And that's a, you know, it could happen, but not everybody who walks and becomes enlightened. So you don't want to have expectations when walking a labyrinth. You know, it's kind of like if you watch a movie and you don't know anything about it, you have a better experience than when someone says, oh my God, it's so amazing. And then you're like hyping yourself up and then you're like, yeah, well, that was okay. You know, so sometimes the way a person tells you about a labyrinth can make or break it. And so I actually did facilitator training on how to share a labyrinth through the Verititas organization. So on Verititas, which is spelled Verititas.org. You can actually become a facilitator and you can take a course on how to properly facilitate a walk so that people have the optimal experience and have the experience that it was meant for them. Because if you say too much or too little, you can confuse people or create an expectation, and that's what you don't want.
That really makes sense. That really makes sense. What is the difference, Angie, between the labyrinth? Obviously there's visual difference between the labyrinth you learned in school and the one that you generally see people build.
Picture here. I can put that up. This is a classical labyrinth that I have up on the screen now. So those who are not on there, you can just do a web search for a classical labyrinth, and that's a typical 7 circuit. So the way they design it, now they call them circuits because unlike a maze you can get lost in, in a labyrinth, they say that you can find yourself in it. And the difference is there's only one way in and one way out in a labyrinth. In a maze, you can get lost. There's wrong turns, dead ends, twists, and things like that. But in a labyrinth, one way in, one way out. And so they call the paths circuits, just like electricity runs in a circuit. So continuous flowing. There's no stopping or starting of that circuit. So you can figure out what labyrinth you're walking by counting from the side inward. And you can see if you count the paths, there will be seven before you get to the center. So this is your classic seven circuit labyrinth. And if you look at the charts, it's 11. So don't worry about the twists and turns, but if you just count those rows from the outside to the center, it'll be 11 circuits. And so that's what you'll see is the difference between a classical and the Schartz one. So there's many different ones. In fact, I have a few other examples here. If you're interested, there's the Roman labyrinth, which looks like this.
Oh yeah.
So you'll see that will be put on coins. In ancient Rome, they put that on coins. And coins, the reason why is labyrinths were known to hold protection. And so when you had one in your pocket, it was protection. So they started putting it on money so that you always had protection. And so there's that, the Roman design. And this is an Ely. And so there is an Ely Cathedral in England. And this is actually another one that I really like. And I'm actually building a second labyrinth on my property. And this is the next one I'm going to do. And this one's going to be done in concrete instead of stones. And that way it's perfectly flat. Wow. And that way someone in a wheelchair could roll over it without having a problem or anybody with problems walking. Because, you know, if you're hard of walking, my current labyrinth has big giant stones sticking out and you could trip and fall. So this one will be a concrete one that will be user friendly for everybody. And there's another common labyrinth you might have seen is the man in the maze. Native American from southwestern Arizona, New Mexico, that this one came out. And this one's a little bit different than all labyrinths. You'll notice if you trace that man into the maze, he never reaches the center.
Around
the center. And the reason for that, they say, is that if you get to the center, you die. And that's when you pass away. So it's a So that was their idea and tribute to labyrinths is you're walking in and out of life, but you never end this life. So you never get to the center. And so the center is when you pass on. So there's all these different interesting traditions behind them.
That's amazing.
Yeah. If you think about labyrinths, they actually go back to 4,000 years of age. It's like 4,000 years ago is when we first started seeing labyrinths, and they found them in caves. They found them on pottery. They found them on clay tablets. Like I said, they found them on coins. And the typical one was the classical one that I shared with you. And what was interesting.
And that would be what Buddhism uses too, or they use Buddhism?
They found in all different cultures. That's what was nascent. It wasn't just primarily like a Christianity or esoteric. You know, it was all over the world different. So Catholicism picked them up later. But the original one, it was like before we had designated religion. So before we would say, so this was, 4,000 years ago when man was still worshiping sun and trees and things like that. So there wasn't organized religion. And so they'd find them in Europe. They'd find them in parts of Asia. They'd find them in Sweden. So they found them all over the world, right? And so in the Middle East, and what was interesting is they found the same pattern over and over again. That classical pattern is like the one they saw again and again and again. So if you think about it, it was way beyond, before we had travel. People didn't just get in an airplane. So this is before people would travel the world. So it was like a unconscious, symbolism that was in our minds and our psyche that humans knew, and they would draw, and it was like the same one over and over and over. So it's pretty amazing when you start thinking about it.
Fascinating. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
So
I did not know it was, you said 4,000 years old.
4,000, the Bronze Age is when we first started. Gosh,
wow. Sorry.
Yeah. They found in Bronze Age, the Iron Age, they found, so they really go. And the farther we look, the farther we see them. And so it's quite amazing to just think that they'd find these tablets and be like, oh my goodness, this is a labyrinth.
It's really old, wisdom. It's amazing that we don't know more about them. They've been around for so long.
They were kind of like, they were popular back in the days, and then they kind of laid low and people didn't understand them or didn't talk about them. In the Middle Ages, that's when they kind of picked up again. And you'll see like in 12,001, AD, we saw that they were found in the Schartz Cathedral was when they first put that one in. So 1201 is when we saw that. And then they started just showing up in cathedrals all over Europe. And so a lot of the floors in Europe will have labyrinths in them. And the reason why is they realized it was similar to a pilgrimage. And so when you couldn't actually do a physical pilgrimage, like if there was plagues or things going on, wars and stuff, they discouraged people to leave the country. So they said, well, how are we going to facilitate this pilgrimage? And they said, well, easy, we'll just have them walk the labyrinth. And so it's, you know, and when you walk a labyrinth, it's like a metaphor of life. So when you walk it, you'll see that your dominant thoughts towards life at that time, in that moment. And so that was a way they would help calm you too, because they found, research shows that it calms both the hemispheres of your brain, the right and the left. So they used to have the nuns at the convent walk it to help them calm themselves and bring themselves back to peace. So that if there was, you know, kind of any issue mentally, emotionally, that was a way to center and get closer to God. And so interesting enough, when they started to revamp cathedrals, they were like, decided to take out the floor or something, they'd realize underneath it were these labyrinths. So when they were, revamping a cathedral, it was like, oh my gosh, there's a labyrinth underneath this rug, or there's a labyrinth under this stone floor. And so they actually tried to take out the one in the Chartres Cathedral, but it was so deep that it was like 10 feet deep. It was intended never to be removed. And so they realized, we can't take this thing out. It's just like, it goes down layers and layers into the ground. And so they did cover it up, I think, at one point, and then they just kept it because they realized it was part of the church. And so it wasn't until like the 1970s that there was a resurgence of the labyrinth in Europe primarily. And that's when everybody started going, oh, it's a spiritual quest. And everybody was kind of like, and that, you know, then you think about after the 60s, free spirit and going against the church and kind of finding spirituality, and religions are not settling well in people anymore. And so the 1970s, it was like labyrinths became really popular. And it wasn't until about 1990 that they started becoming popular in the US. And my teacher that I took for the facilitator program, Dr. Lauren Artress, she's written 3 books on labyrinths. She's actually known as the woman who actually revived them in the US. And so she took it upon herself to really understand the labyrinths, learn about them, and build them in different churches and build them in places. And now we see them in hospitals. You'll see them in retirement homes. You'll see them in rest homes. You'll see them in prisons, at schools and parks. And so that was really because of her doing, because of her passion. And she started getting groups together and to build labyrinths and bring them back. So it's was really a pleasure to have her as my teacher, because she had so much knowledge about labyrinths.
That's amazing. I didn't know that. That it was brought back in the 90s. And
And you'll find when they trace the history of labyrinths, they actually have a resurgence when there is unrest on the earth. And so I thought it was really an amazing thing, because when I moved here, that was right at the beginning of this pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was amazing, because I was like, I need to build this labyrinth. And so I had no idea, you know, that it was probably to help create, because it's the power of the symbol magnifies into the earth and the land. So I'm sending a broadcast to the area to help create peace and harmony. So it was more than I even thought. I was just kind of divinely going. It was like this surge of purpose in me to do it. And then I had no idea the ramifications of what it was doing to the land and people. And every time I walk it and creating that energy and exponentially helping. And then when I have people come here and they walk it, the peace it creates in them. And so it's amazing. Yeah. You know, and so you'll find that now people are building them. And why? Well, people are at home. They weren't going to the office. They're like, well, let's do something with this backyard of ours. And they're like, I know, let's build a labyrinth, you know? And so even a neighbor of mine built a labyrinth just recently too. So it's like, we all had this wake up, like, let's build one, you know, and why not? And it will give us something to do on our property. And so it's quite amazing.
That is amazing. And we don't, I find too, that we don't put enough emphasis or weight on, you know, these kinds of things that we're called to do. A lot of times we ignore them, people ignore them instead of doing what you did, which is go forth and do it, even though you might not know why you're doing it. It could just be because it sounds like fun. But what happens as a result, if we follow our spirit and we move forward with those kinds of things, then like you said, it can be very impactful to the energy of the earth, to the energy of in the healing for people that are, you know, have gone through a lot of trauma also this past couple of years. Like if we kind of start tuning in, I feel like if we can all start tuning into those more subtle things in our life, the energetic subtleness, then that's just going to make so much of a difference, more than pushing through like we've done before. You know, like we think what we know what makes a difference, but I think we've only scratched the surface, really. And so These old practices are really important to get back to. And that's why I love things like the Mystery School and teachers who bring these things back, like the teacher that brought it, you know, the labyrinth and then back to the United States in the 90s and taught people about it. Those are the kind of things I think we need more of, and to share more of with people. Cause it, if anything, it just makes you feel better. Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of everything, right?
Yeah. So like Lauren Artress is the teacher, and her website is theveritas.org. That is her company that she developed, and it's all about labyrinths. So they have videos up there, information, courses, classes, all sorts of stuff. So if you're new to labyrinths or want to dive deeper in it, your listeners can definitely go there to get more information on labyrinths, because it has a labyrinth finder on there as well. So you can put in your zip code and figure out where a local labyrinth would be so you can walk it. So a lot of libraries will post that. And I mean, libraries or parks that have a labyrinth will be posted. So surprisingly, people go, I don't know where a labyrinth is. And then they go online and they go, oh my gosh, there's one just a couple miles from me. So
I'm going to have to check that out. I want to see what's near me too.
Yeah. There's many labyrinth finders on the internet.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. It is something that also you can do. You don't have to really travel to do. It can be something you go to in your own neighborhood or, you know, close by that you can just have access to. And building one is in your yard is great too. I don't have enough yard space, I don't think, for that, but I've thought about doing something like that in my backyard.
Well, you know, you can, and you can make it like a 5-circuit or 7-circuit. You don't have, and like my labyrinth is typically the Schartz labyrinth is 42 feet. And I didn't have that space. Well, I did, except that I wanted to have a walkway completely around it. So I made mine 30 feet.
Oh, wow.
And so I shrunk it down a little bit. So the paths are a little bit more narrow. And at the time, it just felt right to me. And Dr. Lauren Artress actually said, you know, the path has more intensity when the path is smaller, because it holds your focus. When you have big, wide pathways, people aren't as conscious because you don't have to pay attention to that because you're just going to go around this corner. But when the path becomes smaller, you have to become more aware of where your feet are landing so that you stay within the path. And so it actually forces people to walk it very slow and more conscious, which I love. And so that was kind of a blessing for me too, to make it just listening to my intuition and making it a little bit smaller. But so you could build one, and they also make them on canvases. And so you can purchase one on canvas. They sell them in the Veritas store. And so you can fold it up and put it in, you know, somewhere. You can take it to a park. You can put it out in your driveway. You can fold it up and put it away. So it is something you could do. So you can be, you know, move it and you can take it places with you. And then another simple solution is they make these. These are called finger labyrinths.
Oh, yes. So I've seen those.
Yeah. What I'm holding up is just a plastic labyrinth, but they make them in metal. They make them in wood. I buy all sorts of them this year for Christmas. I brought my clients some beautiful ones from Veritas's website. But what you do is you just take a little stylus pen and you can use or your finger, and you walk it with your pen. And you actually trace the little line around it, and you just focus as you move your pen around the circuits. So it's like walking it.
That's great.
Without walking. So you're walking with your finger or with your pen, and you get the same benefit from this. In fact, in the class I took, we actually spent time going through a meditation and using a finger labyrinth, and the students had profound experiences with it, because it's just there. And that connection between going back and forth with the pen and going through the circuits, it's really quite powerful. That's another way. So you could go online and find yourself a finger labyrinth is what they call it. And
those
so
great.
So you don't need one in your backyard. You can buy one, you know, for under $20 and put it in your pocket, or you put it in your purse. And it's a great way to calm and center yourself. Like, have it at the office, you're having a stressful moment, close the door, and you can walk it, you know, in less than 10 minutes. So you could do that on a break.
Yeah, that's a great idea. We need so much more of that right now too. And to help people get to that zero point within themselves, you know, just at any time, right? Because that's really, if you can do that, I feel like you can pretty much face anything. And you know, and then you can also learn how to manage the stress that comes your way, like by, and it helps the nervous system. And so, so when you had your students do that, they meditated and then did that afterwards, or was that the meditation?
That is the meditation. Center yourself, you know, connect with your breath. And then you just, I put on some beautiful music and, you know, you just walk the labyrinth with your finger or a pen. And I usually hand out different labyrinths when I'm teaching this. And so I actually give out these cards, these plastic laminated 8x10 pieces of paper, and they can take them home. And I also give them a choice of different, I have all these in different kinds. So I actually, when I do a workshop, they get one in plastic that's to take home. So they get to choose which pattern. So you'll see that they have four different patterns from this company, and then they get to choose which one they want to take home. And then they actually use that for the meditation. And so, yeah, it's lovely. And it comes, you know, with a little bag, you know, so you put in the little bag and you put in your purse, and then you have it always with you. And so anytime you need a timeout on your lunch break, on a 15-minute break, you know, right before bed, it's a great way to center yourself. So it's an active meditation, you know, so you're sitting there and it's kind of like, I always talk about meditation, and there's so many different ways to meditate. And a lot of times meditators say you need a mantra, and you're like, why is this mantra so popular? And it's something for your mind to hold on to, right? You know, and I have this analogy, and it's kind of, it's not the best analogy, but it's the one I use. It's kind of, if you were in India with your elephant and you're walking through the farmer's market, your elephant would want to try things from all the tables. And it'd be like, and you'd be pulling this 2-ton beast and trying to get through to the farmer's market. It'd be very difficult. Well, that's how your mind is when you're trying to meditate. It's like, you have all these weight of the world. I got to pay this bill. I got to, put gas in my car. I got to take my kid to the doctor. I got to do this. And then you're not meditating because you're focusing on all this stuff that's weighing you down. Yes. So then the metaphor, the analogy would be, if you gave your elephant a banana, well, now he's holding on to his banana, walking through the farmer's market, and it's easily to carry him on because he's happy as can be. So using a mantra works the same way. It kind of calms the mind to focus on something so that you can get to that still point. So a finger labyrinth works the same way. Well, your right brain, your left brain would be sitting there going, oh, I have to focus on these lines, and I have to be very precise, and I got to make sure I'm going the right way, and I make sure I'm not picking up, and I'm following the directions, and it's focused on carving the path, while your left brain can now be free to fly. And so it's a beautiful way to help the brain do that. So it's an active meditation, just like Tai Chi would be an active meditation.
Yeah. And it's so important to help to introduce those alternative ways of meditating, not this, the traditional way. So people can start meditating in some form or another, right?
Correct.
Because a lot of times they're just not even starting because it seems too daunting.
Right.
But I love the active or the idea of active meditation. I do that often because sometimes I just feel like I need to move while I do it. You know, it just feels more comfortable for me. Other times I feel like I can just sit here and be. So it's also playing around with those different, I guess, you know, sometimes you'll feel like, hey, I need to move while I meditate today. And other times you'll feel like, okay, no, I can just sit here today. This is fine, you know, and that's okay. There's no pressure. You don't have to do it a certain way. So I really love that. I love that you give people those options and how to use the labyrinth for those kinds of practices. That's beautiful. And I'm going to get me one of those too, because I love that. So let's see. What we want to talk about is, I would love to talk about, did we hit on much of the mythology yet? Have we gotten into that?
No, I haven't mentioned mythology at all.
I didn't think we had. Okay. So I'm really curious about that. Yeah.
So mythology obviously is not the truth. It's just a story that explains something. So I love the mythology of the labyrinth. And so so what happened is they said, well, where did this come from? So the people created a story around it. So the story goes that King Minos of Crete, he loved his wife very much. And she had this, a fixation for bulls. Okay. And so I know it's kind of a funny story, but he's like, oh, so he's like, well, how can, you know, I have my wife be pleasured by a bull? So he actually hired this inventor. His name was Daedalus. And Daedalus, he says, hey, you know what? Can you just make this model bull for my wife? You know, I think she would really love this. And he's like, well, sure. So he privately commissioned him to make this model bull. And so he did, and his wife was very grateful. And lo and behold, she gets pregnant. Okay.
Oh, wow.
She gets pregnant with this model bull. And so she gives birth to a minotaur. The minotaur is the half man, half bull.
Yeah.
And so they name their minotaur, their son, Astrian. And so, of course, the king, he's very shameful now because he's embarrassed that someone's going to find out that he allowed his wife to have this kind of relation. So he calls up Daedalus again and says, Daedalus, I got a bigger problem now. He goes, I need to find a place to store this minotaur. And he goes, what do you mean? He goes, well, not only is he's half man, half bull, but he has affinity for human flesh and he likes to eat people. So I can't have my son running around town killing all these people. So I need to build some kind of maze or labyrinth underneath my palace. So the palace is in Knossos. And so he says, no problem, I can do that. So he builds this elaborate labyrinth underneath the palace. And he goes ahead and puts the minotaur underground in this labyrinth. And so it is true that you can get lost in the labyrinth. Normally, if you're just walking straight in, straight out, you can't. But let's say you're walking and you see a stone out of place, you might step down to put it back in order. And then you go, well, which way was I going? Because there's a lot of 180 degree turns. And so you switch opposite directions. So if you're not fully paying attention, it is possible that you get confused. So in the story, the minotaur would get lost and he could never find his way out. So of course, the father wants to feed his son. So he went ahead and called up, sent a telegram or letter to King Aegeus, who was in Greece. And he says, Athens, Greece. And he says, you know what? I have this son that I have to keep buried under my house and he needs to eat. And can you send us some live people, some young teenage boys and girls? And he goes, well, how many do you need? He goes, well, I need 7 men and 7 women every year to supply for his needs. And they said, no problem. So the King Aegeus from Greece supplied the King of Crete with these beings every year. And so the story goes on. Nobody knows about it. And then one year he calls him up or sends a telegram, please send the people. And the King of Greece, his son was this very warrior-like man named Theseus. And he says, Dad, how can you keep on doing this? You're sending our people to get murdered. He's killing them. And he's like, this is not right. And he's like, when his father goes, you're right. This is probably a horrible thing to do. And he says, Dad, send me. He goes, why would I do that? He goes, I will kill the Minotaur. We'll end this problem. And his father says, okay, I'm going to send you and you can go and kill the Minotaur. So he sends him off to Crete. He gets there, arrives, and he falls in love with the king Minos of Crete. He has a beautiful daughter, and this is his biological daughter that he had with Pasiphae, which is the wife who was having relations with the bull. But they had a beautiful daughter named Ariadne. And so Ariadne meets Theseus, and he's a strong masculine warrior, and she just instantly falls in love, and he's instantly smitten by her beauty. And so they start talking, and she's like, well, why did you come? And he goes, well, I'm going to be going into the labyrinth. And she's mortified, and she's like, no, you can't, nobody ever comes out. And he goes, well, I'm going to kill the labyrinth, because you don't understand. Once you get in, you can't find your way out. So even if you kill the labyrinth, you're stuck in there. You'll never come out.
Right.
And she says, I can't let this happen to you. You know, I'm in love with you. And there's this instant affair, right? And so she goes, I have a solution. So she gives him a spool of wooden thread. And so he goes at a golden thread. I'm sorry. So it was on this wooden spool with golden thread. And so she goes, put this in your pocket. And when you go in, immediately start uncoiling the golden thread, and you'll be able to see it in that dim light. So he does, and he goes into the labyrinth, you know, and making sure he traces his path. He goes to the center. He's confronted by the Minotaur. He kills the Minotaur. And because of his love for Ariadne, he's able to follow the trail out and come out and marry his sweetheart.
Oh,
and
wow.
So that's the mythology behind the labyrinth. And so it's sometimes you'll see a bull inside the center of a labyrinth. So if you're in Europe or something, you might see that depiction. And that is one of the reasons, because that was saying the Minotaur's in the center. And so because of that mythology, I actually have my labyrinth, and for fun, there's a guy in town that I want to commission to. He makes metal works. His name is Ricardo Bracida. You can look him up on the internet. He's famous for his lifestyle depictions of all sorts of creatures in mythology.
Oh, wow.
And so he builds them. And I contacted him recently and said, hey, could you build me a Minotaur? And he's like, of course I could. And so, of course, now I just need the money to afford his services. But I want to build this Minotaur outside of my labyrinth on the hill. There's a little hill right there. And so when you walk up to the labyrinth, it would kind of, if someone knows mythology, it'd be like, oh, no, the Minotaur has escaped the labyrinth.
That's amazing.
That is the story. And so it's a little bit risque. So you may not want to tell the children that story, but that's the story.
Yeah, I feel like I've heard that story, but it may have changed, like, for kids. You know, when I was a kid, I remember hearing similar things. That's so interesting, though. I haven't heard that particular story before. And oh my goodness. Yeah, that's a weird story too, right? In many ways.
It is fun, though, you know. And I think that, you know, for most children hearing the story, we just tell them that there's one day this half man, half bull creature was inhabited the earth and started eating humans. And so they created this maze labyrinth to put him in. And that way he was safe from the people and never came out, you know, and that would be a good way to share the story without going into too many details.
Right. No, it's a good story, though. It's really interesting. Yeah. The time there's all these stories about, like, half animal, half human people, you know, and it's just really interesting, especially like in Egyptian culture too. And so it was all over those kinds of stories, right? And very interesting.
And you know what's interesting is archaeologists wanted to see if in Gnosis they really did have this labyrinth, and they said they excavated the underneath of the palace and they never found the labyrinth there. So, you know, was it completely a myth, or was it built somewhere else and it's just not been discovered, you know, maybe underground somewhere? But so that was kind of interesting too. It's like,
that would be interesting to find that. Oh my goodness.
Uh-huh.
Oh my gosh, that's great. Okay, so you have a workshop where you teach people all about labyrinths and how to build labyrinths themselves, like we've been talking about. Do you actually in your workshops have people build their own labyrinths outside with you or in their own areas, or how does all that work? And what do you, go ahead.
When I do the workshops, I first teach them a little bit about the labyrinth, and then I have them do a finger labyrinth, you know, and so they get used to that initial experience by walking with their finger. And then I prepare them for actual walking my labyrinth. And then after they walk my labyrinth, part of that workshop is explaining how to create your own labyrinth if you wanted to. So I spend time just sharing with them how I built mine. For example, I used this is a kind of ingenious way to make perfect circles. Is I use this, it's a dog stake. It's like a cork, you know, that you screw into the ground.
Yeah.
Running string for 30 feet. And so it goes around in a circle, like a, you know, like on
that's a good idea. Cork
screw kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so what I did is I just measured the distance I needed with some blue tape. And so I'd go out with the measuring tape and put some blue tape on there. And so when it's taut in the center, I would just lay my rocks and go in a circle and lay the rocks. And then when that circle was complete, I would go out to the next blue tape that I had put on there. So if you wanted 14 inch rows or 18 inch rows, you'd have a blue tape every 18 or 14 inches. And then you would just put another row of rocks and go around a circle until you've done your 11 circuits. And then from there, you need a map of your labyrinth, and then you know where the circuits need to open and close to create the circuit. Cause right now you just have circles. And so that's how I made mine, but there's many ways you can make a labyrinth. You can, if you go online, you'll see simple labyrinths, and you can make a plus sign with dots and start connecting the plus to the dots on the outside. And you can make labyrinths that way. Super easy to do. A lot of people love to go to the beach and make one. And so it's not permanent. Some of them are permanent. Some of them are not designed to be permanent. So those are nice because they will get washed away by the tide by the end of the day. But those are always fun. I had a student of mine just recently take my workshop, and he said, on January 1st, he went to the beach and he decided to build one, and all sorts of people came out and walked it. And he said it was an amazing experience to have people walk something he created.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So you can build them in, you know, on sand, you can put them in dirt, you can make it out of stone. Like I said, I'm making one out of concrete, brick. You, the sky's the limit. Some people do it with shrubs. You can make it with bushes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, wooden stumps, you know, you cut a tree and you use the stumps to make one. So there's no wrong way to make one. And so
I love that.
You can just get creative with whatever resources you have. So it doesn't have to cost a lot of money. And a lot of people take their grass and just, you know, use the lawnmower and make it out of the lawnmower. So you just have the shorter part and the taller part and people see the difference and walk the labyrinth that way.
Oh, that's fun. That's a great idea. Yeah. So I have a question. So I also thought that a labyrinth was also just a kind of a, some people just have very simple spiraling labyrinths that go into the middle and then come back out. Is that still a labyrinth or is that something else? Yeah.
Yes.
So there's a simpler. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, there's terms. Like there's the classical one, which is the one I shared. Then there's the medieval one, which is the one that showed up and the one I like. But there's all different ones. So the ones I've shared with you, like right now, were the ones that are more universal. You see them over and over again. But anybody can make a labyrinth, and as long as the rule is that there's one way in and one way out. Now, having said that, they have now made processional labyrinths. And the reason why, and you did see some before just for, you know, processions, they thought that would be a fun thing to do, but they've kind of had a resurgence in the last couple of years because of COVID. And so people don't want to connect or run across the path with somebody. So they have a one way in and a one way out. So you actually go into the center, then you continue on your path and you leave and exit a different way that you're, you know, technically not confronting other people. And so that is something you're seeing, but the traditional one is one way in, one way out. So you could make your own in any which way you felt comfortable, and it would be considered a labyrinth.
Oh, that's great. I love that. I love that. Thank you, Angie. This has been amazing. Please leave my listeners with anything you have coming up that you want to share. I know you guys have also some other workshops in addition to, you were saying before we started, your labyrinth workshop is usually offered once or twice a year around the same time. And then you have you guys have some other workshops coming up at the Rainbow. Is it called the Rainbow?
It's our Rainbow House.
Rainbow House.
So the Rainbow Hills Estate is the official name of our property. And so, yes, we do run workshops. Paul Check and I, my husband, we run these workshops, and there's all sorts of different things we talk about. Like we're just doing one on art mandala workshop. So it's one on creating your life mandala and learning how to create and then we interpret it for you to help you understand what's going on in your life. And it's the most powerful one. We do it in January every year because it's like new year, new you. What's going on in this year? What can we show you? And what can you see from your painting? And so it's a really powerful transformational workshop. But then we also are going to be doing a sound healing workshop where we're going to teach you how to use tools like rattles and drums and percussions and, you know, singing bowls, and how to use them to create healing in yourself or in your environment. We've got other ones coming up where we're in the works of how to make your own drum, how to make your own rattle.
And
so that's fun. And so we've done a cold plunge one where we did the working out and how to use your breath. So we had a Wim Hof instructor show you how to breathe properly. So when you're under stress, so we had ice buckets where people were plunging into ice and holding in there and staying for 5-6 minutes.
Yuri taught that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yuri,
yeah.
Yes. Yuri taught that one. And so, so sometimes we have additional instructors to come to the property. And so my labyrinth workshop, I just ran that, in December. So I probably will do another one in May.
Okay.
I'm thinking around, I think May 7th, that's supposed to be Labyrinth Day. So, so that will be a nice time. So if someone's interested, they can email me. My email is angiesworld@me.com. That's angiesworld@me.com. If you know of Paul Check on his Instagram account, he posts about our workshops there. So you can ask also if you email me, we can put you on the newsletter. And then you'll have emails about what courses are coming up and if you'd be interested in taking them.
Wonderful. Thank you. And we didn't really get into your fitness background, but you are a fitness expert as well. And and have been doing it for a long time. Are you still doing that kind of thing? Are you more into some of the biogeometry stuff? Where is more of your focus these days?
Yeah. So my background, my background started where I was in college and I gained weight and then I got sick and I had borderline diabetes and I learned how to take care of myself and eat right and entered a competition and then won that competition and then became the spokesmodel for a major supplement company, traveled the world, and then it's just really connecting to what it means to be healthy. And so that's how it kind of started. Then went back to school to become a nutritionist. You know, so in addition to all the esoteric things I dabbled in that you mentioned, I did go to school for my biology degree, as you heard, and then my nutrition degree. So I don't compete anymore. I competed for years and I just got kind of burnt out. It was more of a discipline for me to see if I could, and it was for me, but I get to a point where you go, you know what? It's like, it comes down to these judges deciding which body looks better, you know? And yeah. It's like, this is really stupid. We're not competing for time or agility or anything. It's more of beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So after a while you're like, you know, we all look great. And this is silly that we're trying to give someone a title of you looking better than this one and that. And I thought, this is so superficial. And yeah. So I got out of it. So I did it for the discipline to say, I want to eat clean and I want to have something to have. Like if you have a date and says, I need to look good in my bathing suit in 3 months on this date, I'm going to be in a public setting in a thong bikini. That's very good motivation to get yourself in shape.
It sure is.
And so that's why I did it. And I did that for a while. And then afterwards I went, no, I don't want to do this. But that was my earlier years. And now it's, you know, I'm a mother. So I'm just, you know, learning how to take care of myself. Balance is what I'm learning. Adaptation, yeah. Because sometimes I'm like, I can't go to the gym as much as I want to with children, learning how to work out in the playground, you know, working out with the kids, jumping on the trampoline. And so my fitness has changed, you know, so it's taking care of kids and sometimes just carrying them. I have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old and we have a hill and I sometimes they go, carry me. So I'll have one on this hill, that hip, and we chug up the hill and I'm like, that's a darn good workout.
It is. It's the best kind of weightlifting because they're moving too. So, moving weights all the time.
Unstable balance. So these weights are, so it's great. So, you know, so yes, so I am in the fitness industry and my fitness is me no longer in the fitness industry. But then, yes, I dabble with biogeometry. That's my current passion as well as, using biogeometry I use it for everything. I use it on myself. So there's biosignatures that you can learn about that help your body go back to balance. So if you have a problem with your heart or your thyroid or your lungs or your intestines, they have signatures that help bring balance back in. And so through the foundation training, you learn how to use a pendulum to determine which signature is right for your body. And so I use it on everybody. In fact, I just made one on our new puppy. I just shared with you. We got a puppy. And the first day he cried all night and I felt really, really bad. And I thought, you know, poor thing, he just lost his mother and he's away from his litter mates and he's in a strange house with strange people, you know? And so the next day I thought I need to do biogeometry on him. So actually it's right here on my desk. And so here's our little puppy.
Wow.
And so this is called a emitter. So those of you can see online. And so it's, this is emitting energy into the person in the center or the dog or animal in the center.
Yeah.
And so those are the signatures that he needed to help balance him, to make him feel stable. So some were for emotional discomfort. So he was a little bit sad. And then he was 10 weeks old and they said he was only on milk. And so we had immediately put him on kibble. And so he wasn't used to it. So he had a stomach ache. So one of the signatures was for his stomach. And so he was felt a little bloated and you could see he was kind of groaning. I thought he's just having a hard time learning how to digest food. And so I did this last night and he slept like a baby.
That's great.
And so I thought sometimes that's a great thing to use. It didn't take any drugs, any medicine, natural energy that's just being transferred to him. I use it on my kids. I have an emitter for both my children. My little girl was teething. She didn't want anything, even homeopathic. She did not want. She'd go biogeometry and point to her hand because test off her hand to see what signature. So she'd point to the top of her hand and say biogeometry, 2 years old and saying biogeometry. And she immediately was happy. So I draw these signatures and she's like, thank you. Like she felt the difference because you can draw
amazing
directly on the skin. So yeah, so that's my passion is to use biogeometry in those ways. And I balanced my house and my garden. So everything around has this really nice calming effect.
So. Oh, wow. I'd love, I've had, Daria. It's Abraham's daughter. I know Daria. Her name is Daria. Thank you. And she was amazing. She was on my show earlier last year. And that was a really great show. I learned so much about biogeometry. I have some of the books as well. And with the symbols, I'm going to start using those though, because it didn't occur to me that that's a way I could use them. So that's really cool. Yeah.
Yeah. You can put them directly on your skin. I use these Bic tattoo markers you can get on Amazon. You know, wow. So they're not non-toxic is what you want. But you draw them on tape and stick the tape on you too. And it works just as well. So I made those fancy.
That's a good emitter, idea.
But if you don't know how to make an emitter, just draw them, those signatures directly on yourself, and you can see great results. And they work instantaneously. You start immediately feeling better. And the longer you wear them, the better they work.
Could that be why we started putting tattoos on our body?
It is possible. In fact, when I took the foundation training, they found the earliest man. I forgot how many thousands of years old he was, but the earliest man had signatures that were like biogeometry signatures on specific areas of his body. So like on his knee, on his hip, on his neck. And they determined that they were using biogeometry, energy medicine back then. And so they would tattoo them on the body when you had a problem. Like when I took the course, I said, don't start tattooing these all over your skin until you know you need them long-term. Because sometimes you lose one for a toothache. Well, you're not going to have a toothache for the rest of your life. And so unless you think that signature is really beautiful to look at, you don't need to see it on yourself all the time. So, but let's say you had a heart defect, you know, or something, then you might say, I should tattoo this on my body. So I'm giving myself constant support from my heart or whatever organ that needed support. So, and this earliest man, I forgot his name. I want to remember it, but I can't at this moment, but he would have these ones on his knee. So he obviously had a bad knee, a bad hip, you know, and so he had them on his injury site. So it was giving him support. So, you know, in my theory too, it's kind of like we moved away from that because we got into the materialistic world. And so back then it's like, this doesn't cost money to draw a picture on your skin. No. And so after a time, it's like, here, eat this herb or take this root or do something and pay me for this magical potion. And so we got swayed by materialism. Like I have this in my possession and this is going to get me better, instead of trusting in energy and realizing that if you're in that vibration of positive energy, that will heal you. And so I think we're moving back to that. It's like we moved all in and are like, you know what? I'm not going to spend more money on all this crap. Let's just go back to the basics. And so I still think herbs and all these things are fantastic. So don't get me wrong, but I think that we can do things even more simpler, you know, and why
absolutely.
Not?
I mean, it's worth a try anyway. I mean, you know, you have nothing to lose there. It's
So that's another thing I offer is biogeometry consultations. And so
very cool.
People all over the world, even their animals, they have me help them. So that is another thing I do, which is I love it, you know, and it's just, it's so powerful. You know, it's just such a way to, just recently I had a student, a Czech student from our school contact me because both of his parents had COVID and he was not able to see them in the hospital because they were on lockdown. And so they were in ICU and they said, you can't see your parents. And the doctor called him up and says, I'm just letting you know the bad news. You're not going to ever see your parents again. They're critical condition and they just have a matter of time before they're both going to pass away. And so he called me up freaking out and said, can you help my parents? And I was super busy and I thought, this is awful. And like, it hit me, like, you know, sometimes you get this call to action and I'm like, I will do this for you. I said, you know what, tonight when my kids go to sleep at 9 o'clock at night, I'll be working on your parents. And he's like, thank you. Thank you. And so I made an emitter for both of them. And I kept on tracking them. It became like my hobby. It was like every day I checked them to see if they need additional support. And then I would check in with him and say, look at your mom needs something for her sore throat now. She must be coughing a lot. And your dad needs this now. And he's like, oh my gosh, how do you know? And he's getting reports from the doctor. Wow. And I'm telling him exactly what the doctor's telling him. And that's what's really valid about this stuff. It's like, I don't need to know anything about you. A lot of times I say, don't tell me anything. Just let me find it. And then it's like, then it's more believable. Cause if you say, oh, I'm having a problem with my lungs, I'm like, oh, look, the pendulum says you have a lung problem.
Right. Right.
So instead I say, don't tell me anything. Let me find it. And if I don't find it, let's go back and look for it. You know, cause sometimes there's something minuscule that I might've overlooked. Like when I first started, I had these anatomy charts and I was, the anatomy chart only shows the left kidney. So I would check the left kidney and say, fine. But there was a problem with the right kidney. It wasn't fine. So I now learned, I'm like, I can't just rely on the left kidney. I have to go to the anatomy chart that shows the right kidney. And then I can see what's going on with that one. So I test left, right lung, left, right kidney, and to find the imbalances. So the story goes that these two parents walked out of the hospital It took them a while, but they did in a couple of weeks and they were out. And the doctors were dumbfounded and they said, "We don't understand it. This is a miracle," but they were goners and they're both walking out of here. And so the magic of, you know, energy is powerful.
It is amazing. And So I used to do more of pranic healing, but I do use it for family members and friends, and it's an off body energy healing modality that you can do distance as well. And it does work. I mean, it works. Like I find that, you know, if I'm, you know, like you're saying, you tap into someone's energy field, you can tune into what's happening and work on it, you know, intuitively. But I wonder, like, if it has a lot to do with maybe, I wonder why it worked much better and people used more of it back in the day. Because do you think there was more belief in that and how it worked? And we lost our belief over time, or was the world just different, you know?
I don't think it had anything to do with belief, because I've worked on people who don't believe in biogeometry.
Yeah.
I'll say, "Let me just do it for you and see what happens." And then people call me back and go, "I'm not saying it didn't, but I'm not saying it didn't," you know, like they were like questioning, like, "I don't want to believe it, but I'm just letting you know I'm better, but I'm not sure because I'm doing other things, but it is kind of interesting that this happened to me." And I've had people tell me that. So non-believers have come back and said, "Wow, that's, whatever you did is weird because it's working and I don't understand it." And I'm like, you don't have to understand it to acknowledge it. People just got away from it, or they forgot, or they got so swept up, like I said, with the materialistic world, they were into the newest thing. It's like, you know, it's like people like to explore. So it's like, well, what else is there? Oh, we can take these herbs, or there's these potions, or these rocks, or this energy thing. And they start learning other things, and then they forget about this ancient stuff. So they just moved away from it, you know? Right. So I think that's really more what happened. And then people just forgot. And then they're like, "Oh, that really worked. No, I don't remember where my signatures are. I don't remember what I did." And then it was just like lost, you know? And so this resurgence and the signatures now are being created by Dr. Ibrahim Karim now. The original information came from manuscripts that were ancient, but he's actually making them currently by using that technology. And so he tests the signature, he says, for at least 1 year, because the signature has to go through the test of time. So daytime, nighttime, solar equinoxes, solar flares, you know, all those things, he has to go through, like, you know, the spring, fall equinox, all those things have to happen to see if it makes it through. And if the signature works throughout the year, then he knows he has a valid signature. And if it doesn't, he has to tweak the signature to make sure it holds its intensity. And so the signatures are really thought out. So it's not just, "I drew a picture and here, this is working." You know, it actually takes a lot of discipline to create this and a lot of ability to be in tune with what you're receiving and the information and knowing when it's not working.
Absolutely. That's incredible. I love that process. It's, you know, anything that's a true healing art is going to be tested, you know, and over and over again to see if it works. And so that's how they come to those conclusions. That's incredible. Well, thank you for sharing that, Angie. I encourage my listeners to also get with Angie on some of the biogeometry work she does, because that sounds like it could help a lot of people, especially right now, because there's so many things that don't really make sense as it relates to, if we look at it from a medical scope that people are going through, you know, it's more of an energetic approach. I think sometimes we want to take, we don't want to discount anything, but I think that we have been discounting the energetic aspect of healing so much that it's really time to start stepping into it much more, I believe.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not a cure all. Like, I have seen people I've tested and I can feel like it's not gonna, like, I worked on a guy and he was better. He was in the hospital. He had a heart attack and they said, "Can you help him?" I said, "Well, I can try." And he got better for like a couple of days. And then he started having other problems. So it was like, and then his kidney started having a problem, and then his liver had a problem, and then his lungs had a problem. And the analogy I give people, it's like, he had a really poor lifestyle. He was a golfer, drank a lot, ate poorly, had a big gut, you know? And so it's like, if you have bad wood, you know, as a metaphor, and you have a boat, it's like, it starts to leak. Well, you plug up one hole, then another hole starts happening. Right. And so I just felt like I was plugging these holes on this boat. And I was like, you know, this boat wants to sink. It's like, sometimes if a person's healthy enough, giving them a little support is all we need. But if a person's had a lifestyle of abuse, biogeometry can't save anybody. It can prolong them for a few days. He had enough time. I think he lasted another 5 or 6 days where his whole family was able to say goodbye to him. but I couldn't keep them. I can't do anything. And I always say, it's not me. It's the energy of these signatures. It's like a signature can't keep a person alive who's, you know, ready to go. So, you know, we have to rely on fate and trust and know that if it's our time, it's our time.
That's right.
But if you're called to this, it might be, that's the reason why. It's like, hey, support your loved ones. This is something that can help them. But I'm the first to tell you if it doesn't work. It's like, I don't be like, oh yeah, let's keep on doing this. I finally told this guy, I said, you know, he's ready to go, you know? And I said, and I actually have another advanced training biogeometry tool that shows you the chakras of the body and what's out of balance. And after I started seeing all his organs kind of shutting down, I was like, let's look at his chakra system. And all his chakras, the lower chakras were completely blocked. And then the upper chakras were wide open. So it was like 6, 7, 8, 9. Right. And I said, he is in the spiritual world.
He's ready.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just told him, I said, listen, I said, he's ready to go. And they're like, okay, you know, but I'm the first to tell you, it's like, if it's not going to happen, you know, it's like, I'll try anything. I'll try, you know, I'm always like, let's try, because it doesn't hurt to try.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, you know, it's like, we have to recognize that too.
I mean, people have destiny, and there's a destiny for each person. And like you said, there is a time that they're ready to go, and you got to honor and respect that, you know? Yeah, right. Absolutely.
I like to share that, because I don't want to be like, yeah, anybody's problem, I'll take it away.
Yeah. Don't want to be that person either. I mean, you know, people have responsibility for their own healing, right? I mean,
right. That's a holistic coach. That's to have them take responsibility. I give you tools to help you get better, but then you need to ride the horse and take hold of your life and say, this is what I need to do to keep myself here. So,
right.
Angie's not your crutch. It's Angie's just a support, but ultimately I give you the tools to learn how to eat right, breathe right, move right, exercise right, and you can live a longer, healthier life.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again, Angie. We went over, we kept going. This has been an incredible conversation. I won't keep you any longer, because I know your kids are probably like back there, mom, where's mom? But thank you for taking the time to have this conversation with me and share your wisdom on everything that you're sharing with the world. So I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Allison. It's great to be on your show.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.